Well, I think there's still a bit of that. Like, has inflation come down enough? Is it going to reaccelerate? Mm. Is the recession stuff's gone? But.
So do you do a lot of meetings? And are your client base mainly UK institutions or European, American?
I would say UK and US.
Right. Dan, and is there the sort of tone of the meetings? Does it differ between who you're talking to in terms of...
At the moment, it's me having arguments with US investors about whether Europe is just completely worth investing in or just a complete basket case.
Yeah.
Well, I think if we can, it'd be good to go over that. It'd be good to go over American exceptionalism.
It's a good week for it, given what we just said.
It's a great week. Can believe it. But obviously, you know, our portfolios, we have a home bias to them. You know, we do have, you know, we have more UK equity exposure than MSCI World would. So.
I don't spend a huge amount of time thinking about the UK because, you know, it is what it is. But we can talk about the UK. I used to work with Rachel Reeves, so there's something.
Did you?
She is an economist. I can confirm.
Are you sure?
The LinkedIn story there was pretty extraordinary, wasn't it? With the sort of false fabrication of her LinkedIn profile.
Didn't she make up something about her job at a particular bank?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, but when I worked with her, she was definitely an economist. This was 2002.
And positive impressions? Generally?
I knew her quite well, actually. The last time I saw her, she was giving a seminar on why the US fiscal position was unsustainable. And that was 23 years ago.
Oh, right.
So there's a certain bias there, I guess you could say.
Well, she was right.
How she thinks about... Well, it hasn't blown up yet.
It hasn't blown up yet, but they're 100% of GDP and rising.
So...
Which tracks the S&P quite well as well, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah.
Put your chart. Deck
All right, that's interesting.
I wouldn't have imagined that she would be Chancellor one day, but, you know, she was all right.
Would you sort of think about how they've gone about their business so far in the first 6 months? We might as well start with the UK. What should we kick off?
Let's kick off.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 46. Returning hero of the pod, Dario Perkins. If you want his biography, go back to episode 17, which is on YouTube. Dario is managing director and head of global macro at TS Lombard. If I've got that wrong,
That's right.
And famed.
I think we have to say global expert. Data.
Global data, TS Lombard, indeed.
Or again, told off.
Good. Well, noted for the record. I thought we'd have Dario back to talk about a number of things. Start with the UK, because Dario, it turns out, was a close colleague of Rachel Reeves some time ago. Like most people's criticism would be that the mood music has been way too negative, and that has had a negative impact on the UK economy. Is that a fair assumption? And is it too late to turn the ship around?
I think it sort of answers the question about whether she's really an economist. The fact that she's been so gloomy sort of confirms that she's an economist, particularly a UK economist. I think when I worked with her in 2002, 2003, she worked for the Bank of England, but she was on a sort of secondment at the Foreign Office. So she was sending telegrams about the US economy to me, and I was sort of choosing which bits were relevant and then passing them on to Gordon Brown. So. It was a sort of, she was like our person in Washington.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that was in the days of telegrams.
Well, the fax machine hadn't been installed in the Treasury those days.
I think I missed a few. We've probably still got a fax machine in the Treasury. They've only got one Bloomberg terminal. I can confirm that. I've had that on good authority.
We spoke to someone else that said, who were we talking to the other day?
Adam Smith.
It's Adam Smith. Yeah. He said they had one terminal and
they had a report at 4:30 every day with all the market pricing.
Yeah,
it's true. There's one terminal. So, I mean, the story goes back to like 1992 and Black Wednesday. They were listening to what's happening to Sterling on BBC Radio 4. So, you know, they've had a long history of not being linked up to the latest information. In terms of Rachel Reeves, I mean, you know, she has been very gloomy. I think that her sort of, she's raised question marks about her understanding of fiscal policy, given all this stuff about black holes. Mm. And, you know, I think she was much too gloomy on the fiscal position. In terms of policy, I mean, we can debate the sort of tax increase for companies, but I think you had a previous government that had basically committed itself to sort of George Osborne style austerity, knowing that it wouldn't have to be in power, it wouldn't have to implement that austerity. And this government basically came in and cancelled the austerity.
Mm.
And there's a very gradual fiscal tightening over the next sort of 3-4 years, but it's perfectly sort of reasonable policy, I think. I think the problem was the way the OBR sold that message, because, you know, they had that chart that was basically the thing that moved markets. As soon as the chart came out, that was the thing that people noticed.
Mm.
And this was sold as the biggest fiscal expansion in sort of history. And it was ridiculous. I mean, it was completely the wrong way. It was comparing, you know, what they planned to do to some sort of fantasy counterfactual where George Osborne was coming back. I mean, that was never going to happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, there isn't any sort of big news on fiscal policy. It's a very sort of gradual tightening. They oversold all this stuff about public investment. I mean, there's no sort of investment boom coming. I mean, all of that is just a sort of fantasy. But the gloom, I think, hasn't helped. I mean, all of the sort of consumer confidence stuff has fallen down.
The floor.
All of the business confidence has been going down. Yep. A lot of that seems to be hiring intentions, which seems to be linked to the national insurance contributions. Yep. And so, you know, none of that stuff has been particularly clever.
That's the big worry, is the job market, isn't it? Actually, that could get really quite gloomy.
I think that, you know, when you look at, I mean, the UK was sort of one of the monetary canaries, I called them a couple of years ago, which was everyone was waiting for something to break in the financial system or the US economy. Everyone was focusing on the US labour market. And there were always a bunch of economies, and the UK was one of them, where if something was going to break, it would break there first, because you had higher levels of debt, you had a lot more variable rate debt, short-term debt. And so you're always going to get a bigger monetary squeeze. And looking at the UK data now, it's looking a little bit scary. I mean, the labour market is looking quite shaky.
Mm.
We've had 2 months where payroll employment has gone down, which is, it's not completely unusual, but it's just this sort of cracks beginning to appear.
Mm.
The survey data on employment intentions is horrendous, as that chart shows.
We've got this chart here. We've got in blue.
Now, I don't know if that is genuine or if that's just companies sort of signaling a sort of protest vote against the government. But, you know, these are sort of cracks that are appearing.
Yeah.
And the Bank of England is completely obsessed with sort of backward-looking super core inflation measures and wage growth, which really are giving you, it's sort of telling you what the economy was doing 18 months ago.
Mm.
So I just worry that we're beginning to see some of these cracks. And if we are, then I think the Bank of England is going to have to move much quicker than it realizes to get ahead of that.
And do you think it should be now, doing that already?
I think it should. I mean, I don't think we've got... I think 2 years ago, you could make the case that we had more of a structural inflation problem in the UK. You know, the labour force had gone down. We'd had this big immigration shortfall. So we had these massive labour shortages across the UK economy. The health service looked like it was broken. It was linked to lots of people dropping out of the labour force. You could make quite a strong story, you know, in that time, that this sort of growth inflation trade-off had sort of gone through this fundamental deterioration. And it's all gone. You know, that whole story has sort of evaporated.
The wage growth numbers aren't quite sticky. They're still above 5.
The wage growths are sticky, if you look at the labour market conditions, they've completely transformed. I mean, we've had this massive increase in labour supply that's mainly come from immigration. I mean, you know, UK is quite good for this data because you can get immigration data going back centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never seen as much immigration as we've seen over the last 2 years as we have in the UK.
Yep.
And so the labour market is rebalanced. If anything, it's now looking like sort of genuine weakness, you know, very different to the overheating we had.
Mm.
And I think if you're just obsessed with the wage data and those super core inflation measures, which include things like insurance fees and, you know, car rentals and all this stuff that is lagging from 2 years ago, then you're just missing the story. And there's this sort of weird sort of traditional Bundesbank mentality that sort of set in at the Bank of England recently. I think it starts with the chief economist, who his very first interview he went on about how great the Bundesbank was, which already was a sort of warning sign. And then you've had people like Catherine Mann, you know, sort of unnaturally hawkish all the time. And I just feel that they're sort of risking this now, you know, in this sort of soft landing. You know, they basically almost got to that soft landing. And now, you know, if they don't cut quick enough, they're sort of jeopardising it, particularly given some of the sort of reaction to the tax policy.
Well, I had my old man on the phone half an hour ago, actually, and he was pretty excited because he's read somewhere that someone was suggesting 5 or 6 rate cuts this year, which I think Goldman Sachs is sort of down for 4 or 5. And friend of the pod, Simon French at Palmier, he's down for 5 rate cuts this year. And then that very much that the labour market has turned. Ignore the lagging-y stuff, the wage growth numbers, it's an irrelevance. Core CPI is just a product of history, if anything, and it's not going to happen. We need to be cutting and cutting quicker.
I mean, it's exciting, so you've got a mortgage coming up from renewal, but it's not exciting for anything else, is it? It doesn't say the economy's in a great state.
No, but I think, you know, I don't think we need to go back to the sort of interest rates we had in the 2010s. You know, no one's talking about zero rates or prospects of negative interest rates or any of that stuff. But it's just, you know, the risks now in the UK are sort of skewed towards the growth weakness rather than the inflation stickiness.
Mm.
And I think you need to get ahead of that. And, you know, what really changed in the US, I mean, the US sort of went through this recession scare, which had several recession scares.
Yeah.
But it had a labour market recession scare last summer. And it looked like the Fed was going to fall behind the curve and it was triggering quite a nasty reaction. And then the Fed, you know, cut 50 and it wasn't just the 50, it was this sort of commitment not to fall behind the curve. You know, that was basically what Powell said. And I think someone at the Bank of England needs to give a similar message quite quickly. You know, they need to be on this and they need to be, because you don't want to end up, you know, having to cut interest rates very aggressively to try and catch up. Because that's the irony. You know, if you're slow to cut interest rates, you'll end up with even lower interest rates for even longer.
Yeah.
I think what you say, we've got the two charts here from your note, which we're going to put up, hopefully keep on, because they're quite messy charts. But the one on the left is the average rate on all outstanding mortgages. And the UK is here in red, which, or is it pinky? No, pink is Portugal, is red, which you can see is third or fourth down on the left. But you can, you know, what it says effectively is that since interest rates have gone up in the last couple of years, it's taken time for certain economies to have their mortgages, you know, rolled over onto new rates. The US in particular sort of flatlined, hasn't really moved at all. Portugal and yellow Spain are the two have got clearly lots of adjustable rate mortgages, so their mortgage debt has moved up quite quickly, and the UK sort of sits in the middle of that, where, you know, the average interest rate on debt has gone up quite meaningfully.
Yeah.
So to your point, you know, if the Bank of England start cutting now, there's going to be another lag for this number to come back down, as people have now fixed onto 5% mortgages instead of 2% mortgages, for instance. So it's going to take them another 5 years before they can, you know, refix onto three or whatever.
That's true, but what you want to avoid here is that you're going to get a further squeeze. Even if you keep interest rates where they are now, you're going to get an additional squeeze over the next 18 months as more and more of these sort of 2, 3, 4, 5 year loans reset to higher interest rates.
That's right. He's looking at me.
So that's going to keep.
I am looking because mine's up in October 26.
August 26 here.
There you go. So you've got this. Yeah. So the first point of cutting interest rates is to prevent that squeeze from happening, because you definitely don't want any further squeeze. And then, you know, given that some of this debt is very short term, you could actually get quite a sort of positive impulse from cutting interest rates quite quickly.
Mm.
I mean, that, you know, that line did move up quite quickly. It hasn't moved at all in the US because it's all 30 year rates. But I'd be more worried about the corporate side, actually, which is the other chart.
The right hand chart,
which you can see the UK is at the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, that has had a much quicker pass through. So companies, you know, typically it's bank loans, it's fairly short term, it's tied to variable interest rates.
Mm.
That stuff moves quite quickly.
That's why my dad was on the phone excited about rates getting cut.
So there you go. So there is a point. So people say, you know, what's the point of cutting interest rates? Well, there is a point to cutting interest rates because it's those two effects. And then you've got, you know, this is just the sort of existing debtors that get squeezed. Mm. You've also got this issue of bringing people back in to the market, which, you know, cutting interest rates helps with. So I think there is a case, you know, that cutting interest rates will do some good. I would just get on with it rather than just waiting and waiting and waiting.
Mm.
You're talking about the podcast I listened to recently with you was on cycle lengths. Just saying the UK tends to have shorter cycles because of the debt maturities for individuals, whereas the US has longer maturity debt in the form of 30-year mortgages. So the cycles are slightly different.
I don't think that was me, to be honest. I don't think so.
Is that Freya?
It may have been Freya. I think that, the point I've been making about cycles recently is this sort of fake cycle that we've been in. You know, this hasn't been a sort of classic business cycle. I mean, US cycles have matched UK cycles quite closely, actually, and they've tended to be longer. So you had the global financial crisis, which is obviously the big recession that sort of reset everything, where this very sort of tepid expansion since then in the US and the UK. And then what's happened with this sort of soft landing is we've basically gone back to 2019. You know, the labour market sort of looks like it was in 2019. But, you know, it's starting from a position of full employment. So we don't have to go through that sort of long period of deleveraging. So I'm not sure that the cycle has been shorter. I think that there, you know, there is the issue with the debt servicing is really that you just get an additional squeeze that you don't need in the UK.
Well, we've got a chart up here, you know, on that, as you've been talking about for the last few years, you know, we were not in a normal cycle. So normal cycle, you get, you know, unemployment rises over 12 to 24 months, 36 months, and then it, you know, it gradually recovers. The black line here is the 2008 experience, which was, as you say, very elongated. The 2020 recession looks absolutely nothing like the others. So unemployment fell by 10, 11, 12 percentage points in about 3 months, and then it's bounced straight back and back to where it was, what, 36 months later? At the, you know, so to your point, this wasn't a normal cycle. And then on your sort of, you know, lots of talk about soft landings, hard landings, no landings, on your metrics and the chart that you've got here, we're pretty much back to a soft landing. Is that, do we think we're there, or do we think, is there actually a risk now that this kind of, we go a little bit further than soft landing, and just when people have stopped talking about recession, mainly us on this podcast, it ends up happening anyway?
So on the cycle, I mean, you have to remember what this cycle was about. I mean, we shut down the economy and reopened it. Yeah. I mean, you know, with a huge amount of stimulus sort of flooded into the economy. So it ended up being a bit like a sort of natural disaster rather than a sort of persistent balance sheet recession like we had after the global financial crisis. You know, we had that long period of deleveraging. And this time, you know, the government basically just absorbed the whole problem on its balance sheet. And so private sector balance sheet started, you know, in very, very strong health. And then, you know, the problem that I think investors have had over the last sort of 3-4 years is that they keep asking me, you know, where are we in the cycle? And I keep replying, I probably said it on the last time I was on this podcast, you know, this isn't a cycle. You know, where are we in the cycle doesn't really make any sense, because, you know, we've gone through this sort of messed up, distorted economy. And what we're really doing is normalizing. And, you know, that normalization, it took place via inflation, which started off, you know, in double digits and has come down to 3-ish%. Which central banks will never admit, but that's perfectly acceptable to central banks. You know, given where they thought they were going 2 years ago, you know, they would have bitten your hand off if you'd offer that to them. And so then they had this other imbalance in the economy, which is in the labour market. You know, all these central banks looked at that and said, well, this is the fundamental imbalance in the economy. You know, this is the reason that we need to raise interest rates. That's gone too. And so, you know, I set out sort of three conditions for a soft landing, you know, 4 years ago. One was inflation had to come down to those tolerable levels, which we have. The other one was that we had to have a labour market rebalance, because if we didn't, central banks, you know, they're obsessed with the Phillips curve. They were never going to relax as long as you had sort of overheating in labour markets. And then the third one is you had to have either economies that were that could absorb the level of interest rates, because central banks were basically in some sort of arse covering. You know, it was technocratic arse covering. It was basically, let's raise interest rates as quickly as we can and not care about what happens, because we have to, because our careers depend on it. And so we had to have an economy that was able to absorb those interest rate increases. Or if something started to break, the central banks would have to pivot quickly enough to prevent it from breaking. And we basically met all of those three conditions. You know, the inflation is where they want it. The labour market is rebalanced. The economy so far is absorbing these interest rates. But as I said, in some of those canary countries, and it's not just the UK, it's Canada, it's New Zealand, it's Sweden. You know, it's beginning to look a little bit shaky in the labour market. So there's this question of whether that's the sort of rebalancing in the labour market has gone too far and is turning into genuine weakness.
And some of the sort of prognosticators of US recession have carried on talking about the housing market, which, you know, remains pretty in the doldrums, because 30-year mortgage rates in the States have gone back up to 7%, haven't they? Well, at least they had done. It's probably come back in the sixes now. So that effectively kills new activity in the housing market. You know, if you were owned a mortgage and it was on a 3 because you'd fixed in the pandemic, you're not going to move ever, are you? I mean, you're not going to give up a 3% mortgage rate. But if you want to move, or you're a, you know, you're a young millennial like Alex over there, and you want to buy, then you're a bit stuck at 7%. So that housing market's dead. And traditionally, the housing market's quite a big employer, isn't it? Construction in particular. And talk about canaries. Mm. Lots of people say that the construction sector is the US canary, and that's it, that is deteriorating somewhat.
Yeah.
It was why the house builders were actually, as part of acquiring or buying a new house, they were providing debt on the other side.
So, yeah, there's been huge incentives.
Yeah, 5-year fixed rate at, not much. Basically, a lot less than a bank would give you, and that was, they were virtually giving the houses away on that basis, weren't they, just to get some sort of demand going.
Yeah, so I think the worry here, and it's a sort of residual thing, I'm not too worried about a US recession, but I can see this sort of, there is still this question of whether the economy, particularly the housing market, has fully adjusted to the interest rates that we have. Because for the last 4 years, there's been this assumption that this monetary pivot would be very hard and very quick, and we'd quickly be back to interest rates, before pre-pandemic levels. And so you see this question of whether the housing market has fully absorbed that, or whether people were just waiting for things to improve and they're not. Then you've got the whole sort of commercial real estate, which is sort of frozen in time and hasn't sort of marked to market with interest rates at these levels.
Yeah.
So, the point of cutting interest rates was to prevent this squeeze and, ensure that we didn't need that sort of squeeze now. I do think a lot of the recession narrative over the last 4 years has just been wrong. You know, that it started off, I had several sort of big arguments with investors since 2022. 2022 was all about, oh my God, US GDP has just contracted for 2 quarters. That's technically a recession. That was one. And at the same time, the yield curve was inverted. So you had technical recession and yield curve inversion. Oh my God, it's coming. The recession is here. Mm. And I remember, very fierce arguments with people where I basically said, if we're arguing about whether we're technically in recession, that ain't a recession because... You know a recession when you see it, and it's not GDP. It's not bickering amongst economists about GDP. And so that was a completely false recession. Then the next one was all these sort of leading indicators and manufacturing indicators, which again, completely fake because, we're in a world where we're buying stuff off the internet at home.
Yeah.
We opened the economy. All that spending went into services and it caused a manufacturing recession.
Because we didn't buy any more stuff.
But the manufacturing wasn't a leading indicator for anything apart from itself. And so I think those recession sort of fears were always completely unfounded. And what it went down to is that I didn't believe you could have a recession when you had abnormally high profit margins and you had very severe labor shortages, because companies just weren't going to fire people.
Mm.
And the whole point of a recession is that sort of reflexive dynamic in labor markets. People start to lose their jobs. Confidence goes down, spending goes down, goes back into revenues, leads to more rounds of redundancies. That is the recessionary process. And we were just a million miles from that in 2022 and 2023. Now, last year, there was another recession scare in the US. This one was a bit more reasonable because at least people were looking at the labor market.
Yeah.
They're actually looking in the right place for a recession.
We had one bad month of payroll data, didn't we? It was September, was it?
Yeah, so what you had was a lot of indicators of labor demand, which in a normal cycle would tell you that the economy was about to stall. Mm. So you had vacancies down, hiring's down, wages were slowing, payrolls were slowing, the breadth of payrolls was slowing. And, I wrote another report saying, well, I think this is the sort of last COVID head fake, but this is probably the last one. So we get another recession fear after this, it could well be true. And the reason was that we'd had this weird labor dynamic where you'd had this very strong labor demand, and that had given you all of this this sort of labor shortages, and people were moving jobs quickly, and that was causing wages to go up. Because basically, because labor supply had gone down, you could only grow your business by poaching staff from your competitors. So it gave you this very rapid churning and turnover in the labor market. And then you had, like in the UK, you had this huge wave of immigration. Suddenly labor supply catches up. So all of those job openings get converted into jobs. So it gives you this period where vacancies are going down, where the employment growth had been very, very strong and was now slowing down because they'd been filled. Hiring had stopped because you'd had a very strong period of hiring, and wage growth was slowing because you weren't getting this turnover in the labor market. So to me, this was normalization. Mm-hmm. And it was normalization from what was the fake cycle.
From a high level.
But people were looking at it and saying, well, this is signs of weakness.
Line is going
and
down.
I thought that was wrong.
Bad. Yeah.
But where we are now in all these countries is that the profit margins have normalized. The labor shortages have gone. So if there's any further deterioration in demand, the hurdle for companies to actually start firing people is that much lower.
Yeah.
And in the UK, you know, Sweden, New Zealand, maybe that started and central banks need to get ahead of it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, the recession, you know, there's nobody talking about recession anymore. It's basically gone. And I think, you know, I think that's the main reason that we've had this big reaction in bonds. You know, there's a lot of narratives out there about bonds. You know, is it the fiscal position? Is it the term premium? You know, our government spending too much? Every time yields go up, you get this sort of narrative. But to me, it's much easier, which is you go back to September, you had this view that the US labor market was starting to break and crack, and this worry that the Fed was falling behind the curve. And so the bond market back then was basically pricing in two scenarios. One was a sort of very gradual policy easing, which is one that the Fed wanted us to believe. And the other one, which had quite a big weight on it, was this argument that, well, maybe the Fed is falling behind the curve and now going to have to cut interest rates very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And that's what changed. You know, when the Fed cut 50 and then cut quite quickly and the labor market stabilized, suddenly that recession fear was gone. And it's just reset the whole basis.
Because you're right, because yields had fallen quite a long way into that 50 basis point cut in September, and then that basically marked the bottom in the US 10-year, didn't it? And it's gone up pretty much since, or it's eased off a little bit in the last few
years. And that's totally a benign move. Yeah. You know, if that's the market pricing out US recession, that's a good outcome.
Yeah.
Even for the UK, you know, in the UK, because we have this sort of silly myopic estimate of, you know, fiscal capacity based on whatever the interest rate is doing on that day. It looks like fiscal capacity has gone down in the UK because the yield has gone up. But where would the fiscal capacity have been if we'd had a US recession? Because we would have had a big recession too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea that the fiscal position would be better off in a US recession is just ridiculous.
Yeah. No, totally agreed. Totally agreed. And you've got, you know, talking about where are we in the cycle or what things have changed and bond yields, we've got one of my favourite charts going back to 1980 here of the US 10-year. The UK looks pretty similar, right? But we can see yields peaked roughly about the time that Hughesy and I were born. And they've fallen in a straight line ever since. And they bottomed to August 2020, depths of the pandemic, QE infinity, zero rates as far as the eye could see. German bunds were negative 75 basis points, I think, at the time. It's gone up in a straight line since. I mean, is this a... And we talked about it last time you were here, sort of 12, 18 months ago, and this idea of a sort of secular trend change and a new normal or an old normal, one of the other, I'm not sure which.
So I think last time I hear, I said it would be higher highs and higher lows.
Yeah, and that's how it's been.
See, right? Technical analysis, economists doing technical analysis. I think we've broken that trend now. You know, I don't want to get all technical, start getting my colouring pencils out to do technical analysis. But I think you could see this coming actually before the pandemic. I think there were certain sort of long-term trends that were beginning to change. One of them was demographics. You know, back in 2010s, there was this almost complete consensus in this industry that demographics was deflationary.
Yeah, because this was happening in Japan.
And it just wasn't true.
Sample size of one.
There's a period, you know, what's inflationary demographics is having a very young population or a very old population.
Right.
If you've got lots of middle-aged people saving, then that's deflationary.
Yeah.
Now, we've just got to the point where we've sort of moved out of that deflationary phase into the inflationary phase. And even in Japan now, you know, you have the Japanese authorities saying that they think they're seeing demographics turning inflationary in Japan. So, you know, the T-shirt was all about, you know, Japan and demographics is coming here. It's wrong. So that was changing, I think, before. And the pandemic, if anything, sort of accelerated it because... You know, lots of older people dropped out of the labor force. Yep. So if you look at retirements, it suddenly shot up. Then you had, you know, what got me quite excited before the pandemic was MMT. Not that I believed in MMT, although MMT is right when interest rates are zero, but that's a different topic. It was MMT was a sort of symptom of how far the consensus view had changed. Because after the global financial crisis, we had all this nonsense about austerity, you know, George Osborne economics. People at the ECB were writing papers saying that austerity would be stimulative because it would crowd in investment.
Right.
You know, lots of nonsense was believed back then. And towards the end of the 2010s, the fact that everyone was suddenly reading MMT and you had Ice Cube tweeting Stephanie Kelton's book at one point sort of showed you how far the culture had shifted of, you know, I think he was saying the government is lying to us, you know, there's no limit, we can spend whatever we want. It sort of it showed you how much the culture changed. And even if you look at the last election in the US, you basically had two parties and the only debate was how to spend.
Yeah.
You know, was it tax cuts or government spending? Mm, Nobody was talking about austerity. So that what I call the sort of policy super cycle, that was beginning to change too. So the demographics was turning inflationary. The sort of policy super cycle, you know, more fiscal policy, not all the time, but, you know, different sort of culture around fiscal policy, that changed. And then the 2010s were quite extreme. You know, we had this very, very deep recession with the global financial crisis. We then had, you know, 5, 6, 7 years of private sector deleveraging. You then compounded that deleveraging with austerity policies. You know, the fact that we had, your chart goes back to 80, but you can go back to 1100 for UK data.
Yeah.
You know, we had the lowest long-term interest rates in 800 years.
Mm-hmm.
You had negative interest rates in Europe. Now, I distinctly remember when interest rates first turned negative in Europe, investors sending me emails saying, you know, what the hell? You know,
how does this actually happen? Work?
You know, is this actually mathematically possible that these yields are negative? And it was really just a sign of how messed up things had got. You know, when you've got those, when you've got that level of interest rates, it's really telling you that that mix between fiscal and monetary policy is just completely wrong. You know, you've got monetary policy very, very loose at a time when it's not doing anything because QE doesn't do anything for the real economy.
Mm-hmm.
I think we discussed that last time. Negative interest rates, if anything, damaged the real economy. They're certainly not a stimulus. Yeah. And then you've got governments pursuing austerity at a time when the fiscal multipliers are huge because you've got this balance sheet recession. You know, that was a very, very deflationary environment. And all of that has gone. You know, the austerity is gone. The deleveraging is gone. You know, we're coming out of COVID. We've got the best private sector balance sheets we've had in decades.
Chart here on the change in private sector debt ratios since the financial crisis, showing Spain's got its own axis on the right.
Because it's so big.
Because it were, yeah. But the UK, US, you know, have all reduced debt levels in the aggregate quite heavily since then. Governments haven't, of course, but private sector balance sheets are in quite a lot, you know, as Darius says, in a lot better position, much better shape than they were pre-financial crisis.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that I had to put Spain on a separate axis really tells you something because it's remarkable that that was sort of socially acceptable.
Yeah.
I mean, how did they, you know, they cut private sector debt by 100 percentage points of GDP over 10 years? And well, it's almost forced on you by sort of the German austerity policy and the IMF and all of that austerity culture. And, you know, now, the irony now is that it's put countries like Spain just in a fantastic position.
Yeah.
You know, all this stuff about US exceptionalism, which we'll come on to. You know, I like to tease US investors because I say to them, well, which stock market do you think has gone up the most, the US or Spain? And they'll say, well, of course, the US. And I'll say, well, you might want to check that. Same with Italy. You know, and we get into the topic of Italian, you know, all this stuff about how great, you know, productivity is in the US and how terrible it is in Europe. Well, you know, Italy, everybody knows about Italian productivity.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, no offense. I'm half Italian, so I can say it. But, you know, we've all been on holiday to Italy. You know, we've all rented a car in Italy. You know, fill in all the details before you go.
Mm.
Do it again when you get there. So you've got a 2-hour line to get your car. So it's a country that fundamentally hasn't learned to deal with, you know, basic technology, let alone AI. And yet, you know, the stock market is completely transformed over the last 3 years. So, you know, all this stuff about structural problems, it's true, but, you know, what's priced in? What do we already know? We already know this stuff about Europe.
It's always stuff at the margin, isn't it? And it's expectations versus reality, and that's the way to think about it. I mean, Greece was one of the best performing stock markets for the last few years as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because
they went through hell and they got through it.
Yeah.
And now, you know, they've got more sensible policies. And the irony is that it's Germany and the core of Europe, which is the sort of, the flip side.
Oh, my God, now. Yeah.
Because so do you think the US, with its debt to GDP levels, needs to go through a period of pain at some point as well?
I don't know what debt to GDP is. I mean, like, everyone says debt to GDP. Right? What's the right number? Yeah. There isn't a right number. There's no magic. I thought we went through this after the global financial crisis. You remember the Reinhardt-Rogoff stuff?
Yeah.
You know, if debt to GDP gets to 100%
the Excel format.
And Excel was wrong, had a mistake. And then since then, there's been all these meta studies looking at public sector debt across different countries, trying to find these thresholds. There's no threshold. There's no level where this comes.
I guess the threshold
it's just
is
a number.
The threshold is where debt investors or holders decide, bond holders, there's a problem.
Yeah, and what that comes down to is the size of your financial sector, which, you know, nobody thinks about. You know, the financial sector to GDP has gone up massively. So you actually need debt as a sort of safe haven asset. But also it depends on the sort of properties of government debt. So if you think about the last 30 years, they had beautiful properties. You know, when something went wrong in the equity market, or even like yesterday with NVIDIA, something goes wrong in the equity market, bonds rally, you get a recession, bonds rally. So for a long time, you had this natural hedging property for bonds over equities. And the way that showed up is it was in a, you know, a negative term premium, because the negative term premium had nothing to do with the size of the fiscal situation. Yeah. It was an insurance fee that investors were prepared to have. So the real question mark about bonds and the term premium is not, is government debt too big? It's, are we going to get into a world where that hedging property of bonds starts to deteriorate? And to me, that's if you just get lots of supply shocks. And we've seen it over the last 2 years. You know, when I first started talking about this stuff 4 or 5 years ago, nobody sort of understood the correlation between bonds and equities and the link to the term premium. But we've just lived through a period where we've had supply shocks in both directions. The result of that is that we had a sort of stagflationary period, and then we had this sort of immaculate disinflation period. And, you know, in that period, bonds and equities have been positively correlated. So your hedging properties of bonds went down, so the term premium's going up.
I'm just wondering if I can find a chart on the...
I have lots of charts in there, but I don't know where you'll find
it. We'll find it and put it in.
But any reference to the term premium, that, I think find it.
That, that correlation between bonds and equities has been negative for most of our investment careers. 40 years, but before that it was positive before that, right? If you go back to the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, bonds and equities moved in tandem
when you had supply issues. So I don't think you'll find it there, but I can talk you through it. I mean, basically, it is about the type of inflation that you're getting. So if you, that is in zero, bonds sell off the next wave, it could be in any of those, really. I've been writing about this for years. I think that when I first started writing about this, which was probably 2018, 2017, there was just a sort of belief that bond and equities were always negatively correlated, because that was the world that people have been used to. It was the sort of bedrock of modern portfolio, you know, the 60-40 portfolio sort of relied on that negative correlation. And then... you know, what I'd done back then was I'd looked at, you know, what is it that really drives the bond equity correlation? And what it comes down to is the type of inflation you get. You know, is inflation going up with GDP and going down with GDP, or are they inversely related? So if you've got demand shocks, which is the world we always lived in, you know, series of asset price bubbles, central banks moving interest rates up and down, inflation goes up, growth goes up, then you get a recession, inflation goes down, growth goes down. That gives you this sort of constant positive correlation between inflation and growth. That gives you the negative correlation between bonds and equities. But if you're in a world where you start to get supply shocks, then everything is flipped. Because if you get a negative supply shock, inflation goes up, growth goes down, so bond and equity sell off at the same time. So that correlation flips to positive, and that's what we've been living with. So the big question for bond investors now is they have to look forward at the next sort of 5-10 years and say, you know, are we going to get just supply shocks all the time? In which case the bond equity correlation is always going to be positive and the term premium is massively too low and has to go up. Are we going to get occasional supply shocks, which I think is probably the most likely scenario? So that sort of dilutes some of the properties of bonds, particularly in some times. If you get like climate shocks or energy price shocks or food shocks or any of that stuff, geopolitics, so in those periods, you'd get periods where your bond equity correlation is positive, and then you'd need something to protect your portfolio in those periods. But I don't think it's going to be the case all the time. You know, I don't think you're always going to see. It's not going to be like the 1970s. You know, the big thing about the 1970s was you just had stagflation all the time, so the bond equity correlation was always positive. And so if we had that, the term premium would have to go up massively.
Does technology ride to the rescue, and can we use Chinese AI bots to do our jobs? Is AI the savior?
So I think that we have to have more AI because of the demographic environment. So the way I'm seeing this is there's going to be much more incentive to invest in this stuff, because I think we're going to have these sort of structural labor shortages. So we're going to need the AI. But I don't think AI is just going to replace huge numbers of people, particularly not economists.
Do you use it in some part of your day?
I use it a bit. I don't trust it, to be honest, because I don't know if I can swear on this podcast, but
crap on.
AI, to use a sort of philosophical term for AI, is bullshitting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no sort of understanding of what it's saying. It's just linking together words and giving you, it's giving you sentences, constructing sentences that look plausible based on things that people have said before.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the machine genuinely understands it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I type in my name once into ChatGPT. You know, it gave me this brilliant CV, and some of it was true, some of it was made up. You know, I didn't work at UBS, mm-hmm. for example. But it sounds plausible. It's just that it's not true.
Yeah.
And so my worry is that a lot of this AI is basically marketing. And that's the reason it sort of took off after ChatGPT, because people could interact with it and because it's designed to interact and look plausible. So, you know, the way I think about it is that I'm not sure that we'll ever overcome these problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this idea that you're just going to scale it and it's just going to get better and better and better forever until you get sort of artificial general intelligence and all of us are redundant because you don't need us anymore. I don't see any evidence that that's the case. I don't see any evidence that the sort of hallucinations is going down or reliability is getting better. And so I think that in that world, AI is basically a tool. You know, if you wanted to create a revision timetable for your son, as we did last week, it's quite good. Mm. You know, but you have to check everything. If you're trying to get information out of it, you have to check everything.
But you can't
trust it. So it's like, it saves you time, but you need that sort of human level of checking.
Yeah,
you know, it's like you've got like a really fast, really intelligent research assistant who really wants to make you happy and is just willing to make stuff up in order to make you happy. So you're not just going to publish it to your clients.
You've got to check it first.
So there is a saving there. And in some ways that's good, because it means that this AI, it sort of adds to productivity, because it makes us more efficient at our jobs, but you still need humans to check it and, you know, deal with the weaknesses that it has. Well, so in that sense, it doesn't replace huge numbers of workers, but it adds to productivity. The question is how much?
That's the question. Do you think it will have a meaningful impact on productivity that will lead to decent GDP?
So it depends who you believe. So if you believe academic economists, the answer is no, because the effect is tiny. You know, I think I looked at, there's one estimate out there, sort of 1% of GDP over 10 years, which is nothing. Because it's just, when you look at the amount of tasks that you can apply AI to in an economy, it's just not big enough. Or you can talk to management consultants who will just put numbers in a box and say it's going to add 10, 20, 30% to GDP over the next 20 years. So I guess I have a bias for the economists in this, because they're actually doing the numbers. If you just assume that it's going to, you know, cause massive increases in innovation and science and research and all that stuff, which is what you typically get in sort of management consultancy, then the effect is huge. But I don't really buy it. And I think it's going to struggle to match what happened with computers. So if you look at computers and .com.
Well, I was about to ask about the internet.
So .com, you know, I mean, that basically added about 2 percentage points to US growth over a 5-year period, which is big.
Yeah.
If we come anywhere close to that, that would be really bullish. But it's a stretch.
Yeah.
And the idea that this stuff is just going to transform the world, I just don't really buy it.
Well, we're recording this on Tuesday the 28th, the day after NVIDIA lost $600 billion in market cap. So
it's just like an accounting thing, isn't it? I mean, if you've got, you know, the Mag 7 or the other Mag 7 companies investing huge amounts of money in AI, all that money is going into NVIDIA. Its profits go up massively. You know, it looks like a fantastic investment. If they stop investing for whatever reason, maybe because the returns aren't what they thought they were going to be, or because, you know, there's a new competitor like the Chinese, then, you know, suddenly revenues are collapsing and suddenly NVIDIA looks massively overpriced.
Well, this is sort of fascinating historical parallel, isn't it, with all major technological advancements. And the one that sticks out to me is the UK, this is geekish, the 1841 railway boom in the UK, where... Mm. You know, railways genuinely transformed the UK economy, But everyone who invested in the railways lost a ton of money, a real ton of money. And you only need to go back and look at the chart of the NASDAQ from 1999 to 2003. The internet was perhaps an even greater impact on society and our economy. And you lost 90% of your money if you invested at the wrong moment. So you know, a lot of these major advancements are brilliant, and they often end up having a bigger impact on us than we can potentially foresee at the time. Because I think if you were to be parachuted forward to 2025 from 1999, you know, the internet has impacted us more than the most optimistic of people in 99 would have had you believe, in my view. But you would have probably gone all in on Cisco at the wrong moment, right? So there's a possibility that the AI does do a good job for us, and for white-collar workers in particular, it is pretty productivity enhancing, and the certain tools need checking, but it's also possible that investors lose a ton of money in these things because something else comes along and something else comes along and we find ways to do it cheaper.
I think it was, I mean, we talked about it over the weekend, didn't we, because we're sad, but I think what we saw on Thursday, Friday when the announcement came out was this is almost the next leg of AI, isn't it? Because what they've done is essentially created a large language model at a tenth of the cost of what anyone else has, which means that it probably spreads to other startups, to other companies where actually creating something is much cheaper. You know, that compute expense, or, you know, I don't know how you would measure it, but the cost per GPU, whatever it is, it has now become significantly lower. So actually there's a lot of excitement around what's next, and there'll be lots of opportunities, I would have thought. But yes, are those same four or five companies going to continue doing what they've been doing, you know, and dominate the market? I don't know. You know, probably not. History would suggest definitely not. But
no, I think the issue is that there is a lot of sort of hype around where this technology is going. You know, it's based on sort of science fiction. You know, we've all seen the movies. iRobot, was it the one? We've all seen those movies. And, you know, there's no guarantee that this current type of AI is going to get us there. You know, if they can't overcome these problems with hallucinations and reliability and all of that, we're already seeing sort of diminishing returns set in terms of what these things can do. Yeah. So, you know, I'm skeptical about that. And then you've got this. So then there's a question of, well, how big is it in terms of an economic effect?
Yeah.
And as I say, you know, we don't have a lot of information, but there's two camps, and the academic sort of academic economist is quite skeptical about this. And it's the management consultants who's pushing all of the hype.
Which one's
got, and then you've got, well, you know, even if it does deliver, you know, which companies do you invest in? And, you know, I don't know if it's going to be NVIDIA or not, but at the moment, you know, there's very punchy expectations about what NVIDIA can deliver. And so, and what this really comes down to, what we really learned yesterday, is that it's incredibly dangerous having a market that is so dependent on such a small number of companies, because single stock shares can move a hell of a long way in one day, as we discovered
based
yesterday.
On a headline.
And when that happens, you know, everything gets hosed. So, you know, I think if you're buying into these companies now, it's not that the valuations are completely insane, but to get further price gains from here, you need them to start to become insane. So you're basically buying into a bubble. Now, you know, that bubble may happen. If, you know, if we get the soft landing, then there's an obvious parallel with 1995.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's the perfect environment for melt up. You've got this whole sort of, you know, tech brotocracy in the US with Elon Musk, and, you know, trying to tilt US government policy in that direction, which is sort of helpful for these companies. So, you know, you have those sort of factors, but from a sort of risk reward perspective, to me, it makes much more sense to look outside the US, because, you know, at the sort of heart of the US government, there is this sort of war between the tech bureaucracy of, you know, let's do everything that's great for AI and, you know, Bitcoin and crypto and all that stuff. And then you've got the sort of MAGA, which is very different. I mean, the philosophy there is very different.
Yeah.
So, you know, you talked about the 1840s, but, you know, the sort of MAGA view is that, you know, we need to sort of go back to the late 1800s, you know, with protectionism and tariffs. And Trump talks about what a great economy that was, you know, the protectionist tariff king. And, you know, and that was a world that came after that world that you described, you know, that you had that huge tech bubble, you'd had massive concentration in the stock market, you know, you had the robber barons in mm-hmm. the US, mm-hmm. you know, complete dominance of just a few big companies yeah. in everything, you know, influencing politics, leaning on the president, all of that stuff. And so you have two very different views in the US about what happens now. You know, are we going back to the sort of robber baron world of Elon Musk and
probably already
crypto
there, aren't we?
And all of that
and
stuff?
Zuckerberg and, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So are we going down that route, or are we going down the MAGA route, which originally, if this is sort of rerun of the early 1900s, that was a reaction to a very similar world.
Yeah.
And it involved tariffs and trade wars. And if we go down that route, that's not great for tech. You know, think about the Mag 7 and their exposure to China. Through supply chain,
yeah, Elon Musk is not going to be happy with a load of tariffs and a load of deportations because he needs, well, he's pro-immigration and he's pro-free trade because one of the biggest factories in China. So, you know, there's an obvious split in philosophy there.
So the bullish case would be that those two things balance them out and you end up with a sensible, pragmatic Trump, which is what the whole Wall Street is consuming. You know, you get some tariffs, but they'll be pragmatic. You'll get some deportations, but not enough to cause labor shortages. We won't go down the sort of full tariff route. And you'll be sort of a bit more friendly to crypto and tech and all of that sort of stuff. You know, if that happens, then that's fine. That's a really bullish environment. But if that's true, then it seems there's other bits of the world that will benefit just as much as the US. Right. You know, if we get a very pragmatic Trump, then to me, there's other parts of the world that aren't priced for that. You know, everybody's assuming that in the US that it will be pragmatic.
Mm.
And, you know, that's the case for US exceptionalism. Everybody's very, very bearish about Europe, about China, about the rest of the world. But if we get a very pragmatic Trump, then there's a lot of upside to those other markets. So to me, the risk reward outside of the US is much better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if tech is a bubble and it bursts, the US is going down big and maybe Europe goes down less or even goes up. If that probably happens if Trump is very, very aggressive with everything. If he's very pragmatic, then it seems to me the rest of the world benefits as much, if not more,
because expectations were already pretty in the dumps.
But until 2 weeks ago, you know, nobody wanted to accept the idea that there could be anything but US outperformance.
Mm.
I think that consensus has started to break a little bit, particularly this week.
Yeah, well, particularly this week and marrying off those kind of, you know, issues with, it sort of strikes me that Trump kind of is keen to listen to and act on the person he's just most recently spoken to.
There's that joke about whoever's in the room last with him after meeting. Yeah,
well, there we go. Gets the vote. Hughes, anything else you wanted to ask before we wrapped?
We could keep going for hours.
I think the Trump stuff is. I think it's just too much noise and too many headlines and too much to really kind of scratch away at anytime soon. He's clearly in a bit of a rush to get on with things this time around, isn't he? Because he's.
Mm.
I don't know. It's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the working assumption from everybody is that he'd be pragmatic. So far, you know, he's done a lot of reasonably crazy stuff, but none of it is market moving or threatens the economy.
Mm.
And the tariff stuff remains sort of unclear.
Yeah, the reason for that pragmatism is that he wants the S&P to go up. So he wants the stock market, you know, the stock market is like a barometer of his success.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why the market's kind of a little bit, well, he'll be okay because he doesn't want to trash the market and he's got Bessent as his Treasury Secretary. So I don't know, but yeah, you're right. We've had some pretty mad stuff. I mean, the standoff for Columbia the other night. It's exceptional. I mean, it was all over in half an hour.
And he's gone after, he spent a lot of the last sort of 10 days going after his enemies, which I guess is good from a market perspective because he's not going after
his friends.
Other countries. Yeah. And so, you know, we haven't learned a lot, but from what we've learned so far, nothing to test that assumption that, you know, we're not going to get massive deportations and we're not going to get massive tariffs. And in the end, that's all investors really care about, I think.
What does dear old Rachel and Keir need to do to change the negative mood music in the UK?
Well, they need a better PR department. I think at the moment they've sort of sold this very negative, this very sort of negative tone, which hasn't helped. I don't think they're helped on social media. I mean, you know, Elon and X has turned very anti-UK. I don't think the fiscal situation is nearly as bad as people say.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think that's the thing that's been pushing UK yields up.
Is she not slightly beholden to the OBR now? These OBR reports, that seems to be the kind of, she's living and dying, whether she's got 10 billion of headroom or 1 billion of headroom, right? And in a budget that's a trillion or 1,000 billion. So you...
I think there's a genuine problem in the UK. Is it like a Treasury view? You know, I mean, I used to work at the Treasury. I can say this. You know, there is this sort of Treasury view, and you know, clearly she believes it. Clearly the whole civil service believes it. You know, it's this sort of, you know, being careful, balancing the books. You know, it's a very sort of conservative approach to policy, and it's also infected the Bank of England because you've got so many MPC members now that are sort of former Treasury officials. Yeah. That there is this sort of negative, you know, when Andrew Bailey was talking about, you know, this wasn't that long ago, maybe 18 months, he said that the supply side of the UK economy was the worst he'd ever seen. It's ridiculous. I mean, you think about the 70s.
The 70s, yeah.
You know, I always joke about the 70s.
We had this rally the night.
Well, I joke about the 70s because you know that film, Carry On Convenience, where they're building toilets in a toilet factory. And every sort of scene... something will go wrong or annoy the unions and they'll all walk out and they're like, everyone down tools and walk out. You know, this was all the time. And if you look at the sort of worker militancy in that period, I mean, we're nowhere close to that. The supply side in the 70s was just horrendous. You're looking up, carrying up convenience. So, you know, we're a long way from that sort of world. You know, if they can cut interest rates and deliver this soft landing, we're actually in quite a good place. You know, private sector balance sheets are in really good shape. Corporate balance sheets are in good shape. I think that, you know, we're getting decent real income growth because wages are outstripping prices.
Mm.
I think you start to see productivity improving because one of the things that happened in the US is that you've been in this period where companies could basically grow their profits by just increasing their prices.
Mm-hmm.
And actually they were willing to let output go down in that period. As you get into a world where companies are more reluctant to raise their prices, but consumers are getting it in real income and spending it, you get productivity growth from that. So I think we've seen this very strong pickup in US productivity. To me, that's all cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about AI.
Fine.
And I think you'll start to see that in Europe.
Yeah.
Mm. And you start to see that in the UK. So I actually think the foundations are all right. It's just that the labour market right now sort of worries me a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully I certainly think the change in the mood music in the last week or two has been helpful from Prime Minister and Chancellor in the UK. And I think what's happening in the States with, you know, unbridled optimism, perhaps up until yesterday, I think that, you know, lots of people in the UK have looked across the Atlantic and said, well, maybe we could do with it. A very un-British thing to say, but maybe we could do with a bit of that, you know, jumping up and down. And actually things are... Education system's very good. We've got three of the best universities in the world. We sit in the middle of the world. We've got English law. We've got the English language. And lots of people, you know, still want to come here. So... Maybe we should start there.
And if you cut interest rates, you'll get quite a quick effect on the economy, quicker than in the US.
Well, that's encouraging.
So
that's encouraging.
You know, when we're talking about five rate cuts, presumably we're talking 5.25s.
Yeah.
So it's only 1.25%.
So the market isn't priced for that, I don't think. I think the market is on
two or three. Yeah.
ECB is on 4-ish. Bank of Canada is on 4. I think the UK should be closer to those than the Fed. You know, I think the labour market looks a little bit shakier than the US.
Mm.
But there's no reason why they can't get ahead of it.
Yeah, I mean, we've got the built-up, you know, level of built-up savings is huge. We just need to convince people to do a bit of spending.
Yeah, and that's a bit of confidence.
It is, and we know why people feel negative. It's just getting that message out there. As you say, fire the PR department and get a new one.
I don't think it helps, you know, the sort of constant negativity from the government.
No,
but we have, you know, we've been through, you know, from this is true from a whole European perspective, but we've just been through this enormous cost of living crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, real wages got absolutely hammered.
Yeah.
And from a European perspective, we've been in a global recession for 3 years.
A manufacturing-led recession.
Because, you know, global goods demand, which is the stuff that we trade, has gone down for 3 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've lived through that. You know, the global manufacturing recession is ending. Real wages are turning positive again. If the central banks are cutting interest rates quite quickly, you get a quick pass-through from that.
Mm.
You know, these are quite good foundations to be on. Mm. And there's nothing wrong in the private sector. You know, when you look at private sector balance sheets, this is the best economy we've had in 20, 30 years.
Because you do forget this sometimes, that sectors, we've got sort of these rolling sector recessions, haven't we? We talked about it when we first started the pod quite a lot, and actually we haven't discussed it for a while, but you're exactly right. There have been, and actually, in, even in the US, you take the tech bit out of it. I know financials were very good last year because of where base rates were, or where interest rates are, so they're very profitable. But there are other sectors mm-hmm. that, you know, have had a really tough struggling. Couple of years. Yeah. So maybe we can have this rotation to more normal sectors, which would certainly suit European and UK markets.
Yeah. We saw a little bit of that yesterday as well.
Yeah, we market, did. Market yeah, John was messaging me saying, "But best day ever, all his stocks were up." So.
It's a bit unfair. Good. Dario, pleasure as always. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Good to be here.
Get home. The lights have just flickered on us. It's probably
time to go home.
It didn't light the optimism on me.
No, it didn't.
I just got to my most optimistic on the UK and then the lights cut out. I mean, that says it all, doesn't it?
Thank
that's
you
your
very
mate,
much.
Rachel. Pressing the button.
Rachel from the BOE. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us today. Any questions, let us know. James.Hughes@CourtsAchieveIt.com and I'm Jonathan.Raymond@CourtsAchieveIt.com, and we'll see you next time. Thanks very much.